First, I'd like to thank the organizers to give me the opportunity to give this talk here. And before really starting the real subject of my talk, I would like to show you, say, as an appetizer, one corollary of the main result that I want to present today, and a corollary that I think you can immediately understand. So the corollary is the following. I will show you an explicit example of a 2-1 factor, which has, say, no finite index subfactors, but, well, you have to take this with a grain of salt, because you always have what I will call a trivial subfactor, namely one which is isomorphic to a 2-1 factor included in two matrices over the 2-1 factor. Of course, you never exclude this as a subfactor. And here goes the example. The example will be constructed as a co-cycle cross product. So you have an action of a group on a probability space, measure preserving, and you will have a scalar 2-cocycle on the group. And what are the data? Well, the group involved is the group SL2Q cross Q2, the semi-direct product. And the action involved is a kind of Bernoulli action. So first of all, you have SL2Q cross Q2 that acts on this countable set Q2, just affine, in the affine way. And you amplify this, say, by taking a base probability space and to take it to the power Q2. And act by shifting, of course, the indices. Now, what are the conditions in order to get no non-trivial finite index subfactors? Well, you should first of all take this space x0 to be atomic with distinct weights. And you take the obvious 2-cocycle, basically the only scalar 2-cocycles you can write on this group. So you start with the 2-cocycle on the group Q2, which is invariant under the action of SL2Q, and you extend it. And this co-cycle cross product is the factor I'm looking for. And another thing to say is, as a 2-1 factor, its isomorphism class remembers this base space and this real number alpha. So we are here remembering the base space means that you remember the values of the atoms, the weights of the atoms. So you get a huge list of non-isomorphic 2-1 factors with this property. Now, the talk that I will be actually giving is more conceptual than that. So I will take my time to introduce something that several of you probably know very well, namely the notion of the fusion algebra of a 2-1 factor. And then I will show you some explicit computations of this fusion algebra for a family of 2-1 factors. So this means that while doing these computations, in fact, we will identify these fusion algebras with certain Hecker algebras. So I will show you what I mean with Hecker algebra in this context and give you some identification results. And then I will try during a few slides to sketch the idea of the proof of such computation of all bimodules. And the crucial ingredients will be the deformation rigidity technique of Sorin Popa that we already saw when Taka illustrated his proof of uniqueness of Cartan subalgebra, and also the co-cycle superrigidity theorem, I will state it later, will play a crucial role. And as a last result, I will give you some corollaries on outer automorphism groups of 2-1 factors, and in particular, and this is some slight improvement compared to what we could do before, namely I will show you in a very concrete way, in a constructive way, how any countable group can be realized as the outer automorphism group of a 2-1 factor. So in a joint work with Sorin, we had every finitely presented group, but in fact any countable group does the job. So let me start with this introduction to bimodules and the fusion algebra. So first, something you know very well. So what is a module over a 2-1 factor? It's nothing else than a Hilbert space representation, so the canonical one being just L2 of M. And you all know that M modules, in fact, can be classified quite easily by their Murray von Neumann dimension. And one way to state this is to say that any M module is, in fact, isomorphic with a direct sum of modules of this form. And then the dimension is defined as the sum of the traces of the projections Pi. And this is a complete invariant for right M modules. Now, just rider modules, this is not a good idea of, say, constructing a representation theory of two unfactors, because it's too easy. Any two unfactor, its representations are classified by this real number. Yeah, but things completely change if you rather look at bimodules. So we will call an MM bimodule of finite Jones index if it is an MM bimodule for which both as a left and as a right module the Murray von Neumann dimension is finite. And we denote with this funny notation the fusion algebra, namely the set of, say, equivalence classes of all finite index bimodules of the given two unfactor M. Now, this fusion algebra of M carries quite a lot of structure, and before explaining you this a little better, let me show you different ways in which such bimodules arise. Yeah? The first obvious way in which bimodules arise is by automorphisms. So you take any automorphism of your two unfactor, and then in fact the usual bimodule structure on L2 of M can be perturbed on one side by the automorphism alpha, and this defines you a bimodule. Let's denote it H alpha. And in fact, it's not too hard to show that these are exactly the bimodules which have both left and right dimension equal to 1. But there are other bimodules, and this gives the link to my first slide on subfactors. Namely, whenever M in M1 is a finite index subfactor, I can, of course, look at L2 of M1 as a finite index bimodule over M. So in a way, the bimodules are, the subfactors are somehow encoded in the fusion algebra of the two unfactor. Although this way is a little indirect. Now, generally speaking, this fusion algebra carries quite a bit of structure. So of course there are a few obvious things, like to take direct sum or to have this what we call identity bimodule. But there is also the tensor product over M of two MM bimodules, and it is, let us just be happy here with saying that if I take this bimodule defined by an automorphism, this tensor product is like composing automorphisms, of course. And then finally, there's something that resembles the inverse, and that's the contragradient bimodule. And because of all these reasons, this similarity with automorphisms, we could somehow consider this finite index bimodules as a kind of generalized automorphisms, so as generalized symmetries of our two unfactor. Now, before we do some more advanced things, let me show one last very elementary slide. Namely, I want to show you how this fusion algebra of a two unfactor M, in fact, encodes several other invariants, namely, more precisely, the automorphism group of M, as I already hinted at, but also the fundamental group of M is encoded in the fusion algebra. And this is done under the form of, let's say, group-like elements of the fusion algebra. So in general, let me go one slide back, you have this contensor product of two bimodules, and if I take the tensor product of two irreducible bimodules, exactly as with representations of groups, it's no longer irreducible in general, but it breaks up as a direct sum of irreducibles. Now, in certain cases, it is irreducible, and that's what we call group-like bimodules. Say. And one way to define them is to say that a bimodule is group-like if the tensor product with its contragradient is the identity bimodule. Now, here is an almost general example of how to write a group-like bimodule. Namely, you just take an isomorphism between M, and not M itself, but some corner in M. So you take a projection, P, and such an isomorphism. Then, of course, on this Hilbert space, L2 of M, go down with P, I can write this bimodule structure. Yeah? And you see already the hint that having such isomorphisms, which has to do with the fundamental group, is carried over to some bimodule. And in fact, more precisely, if I define the outer automorphism group of M as all the automorphisms divided by the inner automorphisms, then you have the easy observation that in fact these group-like bimodules, they form a group, of course, and they enter into this short exact sequence with the outer automorphism group and here the fundamental group of your two unfactor. So that's just a way to show that it encodes, the fusion algebra encodes both these invariants. Now, before stating the main theorem, so the main theorem that I will show you is some family of 2-1 factors for which I can exactly say what is diffusion algebra. Now, I have to identify it with some abstractly known fusion algebra, and I think that there is no general consensus of what is the good definition of a fusion algebra. What you should keep in mind is very easy. It's like representation theory of a compact group. Yeah, that you have some irreducible objects, call them G, and the product of two irreducibles breaks up as multiples of irreducibles, yeah, that we call multiplicities. So here is the very precise definition. You have some product, you have a neutral element, you have a contragradient, and then very importantly, you have Frobenius reciprocity. So the multiplicity with which Z appears in the product X of X and Y is the same as the multiplicity with which X appears in the product of Z and Y bar. So, and this is what I call abstractly a fusion algebra. So more important for us is to keep in mind examples, yeah? So of course you have a group, which in such a stupid way can be regarded as a fusion algebra. Already more importantly, you can take all finite dimensional unitary representations of a compact group, modulo unitary equivalence, or more generally, what we will see in a minute, all finite dimensional unitary representations of any given group form such a fusion algebra. And also the fusion algebra of a 2-1 factor is such a fusion algebra. Now, more importantly for us is fusion algebras arising from Hecke pairs, so Hecke algebras. So what is a Hecke pair? Let's say that if I'm given a group G with a subgroup gamma, I call this a Hecke pair. If gamma is, and this is again such a almost normal, I don't know, after the talk of Andreas and Jesse, I don't dare to use any dot 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 normal anymore. But anyway, here is the definition. So normal would of course be that this intersection of the conjugate of gamma and gamma is the whole of gamma. Now, almost normal means that for any G in G, this intersection here has finite index in gamma, yeah? So this is what is usually called a Hecke pair. Another way of saying the same thing is that any double class in G, so any class gamma G gamma, double class as that, consists of a union of finitely many left classes or finitely many right classes, yeah? Now, if you have such a Hecke pair, you can define its Hecke fusion algebra. In fact, in quite a similar way as you would define some group algebra with some kind of convolution product. So you would look at all finitely supported bi-invariant functions on G, and you have this usual convolution-like product, and this defines you a fusion algebra. Now, if this fears you a little bit. In fact, the set of irreducibles is just a set of double classes, of course. And if you take a little bit of care, you can read the fusion rules. But well, it's a little bit tricky to read them from these formulas. Yeah. Now, let me show you an example. So, an important example of such a Hecke pair and corresponding Hecke algebra arises as follows. So, take a k-valent tree, so just a tree such that in every vertex you have k edges, and take a countable subgroup of the automorphism of the tree, which is dense in the, say, the usual pointwise topology, so meaning that for any automorphism of the tree and any finite set of the tree, I find something in G that is the same as the given automorphism on this finite set, yeah? That's the denseness I'm referring to. In particular, for instance, it acts transitively in any kind of degree on the tree. So now I choose a vertex, E, and I define gamma as the stabilizer of this vertex. So that's by its very construction. It will be gamma in G will be a Hecke pair. Okay, so it's the stabilizer, well, those elements of G stabilize E, of course. And then it's not too hard to see that the double classes are exactly given, well, first of all, because gamma is the stabilizer of a vertex and G acts transitively, G mod gamma you identify with the tree, of course, that's the orbit. So G mod gamma is the tree, and then the double classes, you can identify them with natural numbers simply by the distance to the origin that we fixed, yeah? So we label double classes by natural numbers given by distance to the origin. And then I can say you with this Hecker pair of gamma in G, what are exactly these multiplicities and diffusion rules? Namely, suppose that I want to compute the multiplicity of a natural number n in the product of a and b. Well, then I choose any vertex at distance n from the origin, and I look at all the possibilities to have, say, all the ways to go from E to S via T, so that you have first a path of length A and then a path of length B. You can try to compute this combinatorially. Yeah. Now, why am I saying all this? Because this is the one of the ways to understand the Hecker fusion algebra that goes with this classical Hecker pair of PSL2Z into PSL2Q. Yeah. Okay, so this is the Hecker fusion algebra for any Hecker pair, and this we should keep in mind for the rest of the talk. Now, here is the main theorem. So, the 2-1 factors that we will consider are such cross-product 2-1 factors, where the data is a countable group that acts on a countable set, and then I take such an amplified, such a Bernoulli action by shifting the indices. Now, under the right conditions, and I will show you immediately what these are, they are quite simplified now, you can exactly say what is diffusion algebra. In fact, it enters in some kind of exact sequence. You have two fusion algebras involved, namely finite dimensional representations of gamma as a sub-fusion algebra, and somehow the Hecker algebra of a Hecker pair gamma in G as a quotient, and it's split the sequence. Now, what is G? G is nothing else than the commensurator, and I will write immediately the definition, as the commensurator of gamma into the permutation group of I. So this is completely countable, discrete object. Yeah, you see gamma x by permutations of I, and I can look at the commensurator of gamma inside this larger group. In fact, the actual statement is slightly more precise. There is a canonical way, given a Hecker pair gamma in G, there is a canonical way to define a kind of extended Hecker algebra that enters in such an exact sequence, and you identify the fusion algebra with this, say, extended Hecker algebra. So what's this commensurator? Just to fix notation, we will use it quite a bit. Well, here, maybe another group, because G is defined as this commensurator. So say H is nothing else than all elements in H that commensurate gamma. So this means that gamma G, G gamma G inverse in gamma is finite index. You need a group, so you need the same with G inverse. Say. So that's the commensurator of a group gamma in H. Now let me go back first. So before showing you what kind of group actions we will consider, and before giving some indication of the proof, let me show some concrete computations that come out of it, yeah? So on the next slide, I give you some of these actions of gammas, some gammas on sets I, and I give you the Hecker pairs that go with it, and for which you get this Hecker fusion algebra as the fusion algebra for 2-1 factor, yeah? So the first example is to take SLNZ cross QN acting on QN, and the resulting Hecker pair is the one that's written there. You can somehow modify it. You can obtain also the following Hecker pair. Take any, almost any subgroup lambda in PSLNQ and take its commensurator. So this is quite a general way to generate Hecker pairs. In fact, also this one you can get as the fusion algebra of a 2-1 factor. And how do you do it? Well, I have to say you what's gamma and what's the action I. Well, one way of doing it is simply saying let this direct product group, gamma cross PSLNQ, act by left-right action, so you have left and right multiplication, on the set PSLN Q. A funny example that I mainly introduced to make some link with well-known Hecker algebras is the following. Take any ring that sits strictly between Z and Q. So this means that you just take some set of prime numbers and you declare them to be invertible, yeah? So that's the way to define a subring between Z and Q. Then here you get a Hecker pair. So you have this semi-direct product group with this almost normal subgroup. And in fact, it's extremely related to the Hecker algebra of the BOST-COM system, the one that arises here. And also this one you can get as the fusion algebra of a 2-1 factor. And I should again say what's gamma and what's the action I. And it goes as follows. Well, I don't tell you it exactly, but you take the group SL2Q cross Q2, as before. You write some natural subgroup involving your R, and you look again at some left-right action, and you even have to add a 2-cocycle. Well, don't mind. The only message I want to tell you is, in fact, that you can also get this one as a fusion algebra of a 2-1 factor. And it has some interest, because if you look at a bimodule over a 2-1 factor, you have its left dimension and you have its right dimension, yeah? And both might be different. Well, this is an example where indeed both are different. And then you have these ratios that form some modular group and so on. And that's the whole starting point of the story of BOST-CON Hecker algebra, where you then continue to look at KMS states for this modular group and so on and so forth. Yeah. So this is the only example in my list where these left and right dimensions are different and where you really have a Hecker fusion algebra with some modular group involved. Yeah. So, and the final example was the one that was on the first slide. Yeah? If you take SL2Q cross Q2, acting on Q2, and you add this 2-cocycle, you get a trivial fusion algebra. So these are the main concrete examples that I wanted to show you. Now, what are the kind of group actions that we consider? So, first of all, as in Popper's talk, the rigidity comes from some relative property T. So this means that we slightly relax. Already Sorin told that, in fact, a very weak normality suffices. So we take a group that admits an infinite, almost normal subgroup with the relative property T of Kasdan-Margolis. And here are the conditions on the action. So we only look, that's not very crucial, but it simplifies a lot, at transitive actions, gamma acting on I. And then very crucial, as we will see, if I take the stabilizer of one point in I, it should have infinite orbits anywhere else. Okay? So the stabilizer of one point acts with infinite orbits, except, of course, on I0. And then a condition that maybe fears you, but I will show you immediately that it's quite natural. It's called minimal condition on stabilizers. This means that it's impossible to have in I an infinite sequence such that the stabilizers of this sequence form a strictly decreasing sequence of groups. Okay? Why is this quite natural? Well, for instance, it's automatic if your kind of action, and many of the actions that I've shown you were like this, embed or somehow linear or affine or have something to do with some finite dimensional vector space, yeah, because once you can embed your action in such kind of group acting on a vector space V, finite dimension, then such kind of conditions only come from the fact that you cannot have a strictly decreasing sequence of subspaces in your vector space. Yeah. Another motivation for this kind of condition is that if you look at the left-right action of a group lambda on lambda itself, then this condition is the same as something that has been studied quite a lot in group theory, and what's called in group theory the minimal condition on centralizers, meaning that you cannot have a sequence of elements in your group such that the centralizer of this sequence is a strictly decreasing sequence of subgroups. Yeah? And many, many groups satisfy the minimal condition on centralizer. Yeah? All are linear groups, of course, and also all small cancellation groups, hyperbolic groups, many, many classes of groups satisfy this kind of condition. Okay, so these are the kind of actions that we look at. And let me now show you, in fact, why all these conditions, where do they pop up, yeah? So we start, say, from scratch, take such an action of a group, take its Bernoulli action, and it's associated to one factor, and take such an MM bimodule. Why should I be able to tell anything about this bimodule, yeah? And this goes in different steps. And the first step says that, in fact, this bimodule, this MM bimodule, somehow preserves L of gamma. So recall, M is this cross product, and it contains L of gamma, of course, as a subfactor. So the first step will be to show that this bimodule contains an L of gamma sub-bimodule of finite index. So that's the first step in the proof. And here, and I will sketch it very briefly, we crucially use Popper's malleability, which is a deformation property, and we also crucially use this minimal condition on the stabilizers. I will give you an argument for that. The next step, once we have said that, well, this bimodule in fact is contains such a finite index bimodule over L of gamma, the next step is to say, well, in fact, this bimodule should also preserve automatically the Cartan subalgebra. So you should also contain automatically an L infinity of X subbimodule of finite index. So that's the next step. Once you are there, you will write all kinds of cocycles, and I will explain you, and apply to them Sorin's cocycle superrigidity theorem, and argue that this bimodule can somehow be obtained by the commensurator of gamma in the automorphisms of X mu. So here is an important step. Gamma acts on X mu, so you can view gamma as a subgroup of all these measure-preserving automorphisms of your probability space, and look at its commensurator. Now, this is something that in principle should fear you. Yeah, I take some group acting on a probability space. What is its commensurate? You have almost no clue for that in general. But in this very specific case, you can reduce it to some countable combinatorial data and identify it with some commensurator in this group. Well, now the main ingredient will be that this stabilizer of one point acts with infinite orbits anywhere else. Now I want to warn you, so if you need a nap, I will show you two little technical slides. I will wake you up after them. So the two technical slides will give some sketch of one and two, yeah? I will try to explain why this strange condition, minimal condition on stabilizers, is crucial. And I will try to explain you why, for one reason or another, automatically you should preserve Cartan subalgebra. But if you don't feel like listening, I will wake you up in two slides from now. So step one, still the same data, yeah? You take your cross product given by this action, and you take a bimodule. And now I will make some simplifying assumptions just to go straight to the main idea, yeah? So instead of assuming that I have an arbitrary bimodule, let me assume that it's in fact given by such an automorphism of your 2-1 factor, yeah? Such a specific type of bimodule. And let me also assume, instead of this relative property T, that in fact your gamma has plainly property T. Yeah? Let's not make life too difficult. And then I want to show, so psi is now an automorphism of this algebra. And I want to show you that psi of L of gamma being this subalgebra here, and L of gamma itself are in fact unitarily conjugate. Now where does this come from? The first crucial ingredient is Popper's malleability property, and very roughly, and I'm again oversimplifying, it states you a very strong deformation property of these kind of Bernoulli actions, namely you have a flow on the direct product of X with itself, which is commuting with this diagonal gamma action, and it connects you the identity map in the point T0 with a flip map in the point T equal 1. So this is a very strange property. It's a very strong deformation property of your Bernoulli action. Now, since alpha t commutes with this diagonal gamma action, I can extend it to this cross product, trivially acting on gamma. And I look at my algebra P, that's of interest for me, this psi of L of gamma. And I look at it, it's a subalgebra of M. So I look at it sitting, say, in the first variable on X. Here we have L infinity of X cross X. And I look at the first variable inside this subalgebra. And let me now look at, so P is this subalgebra, and I have this flow alpha T. So alpha T of P is this flow of property T subfactors. Now, very morally, if you have property T and you have some continuous deformation, by property T, this deformation should locally be constant, yeah? Now, the interval being connected, it basically means that your flow is as a whole constant, and it will give you that alpha 0 of P and alpha 1 of P are unitarily conjugate, very roughly, because of property T. So it's really the play between malleability and property T. But then you should look very well, alpha 1 being the flip, you have shown that this algebra P that sits either in the first variable or in the second variable is unitarily conjugate. But the only way that this will be possible is in fact that, because it lives in fact in L of gamma, yeah, where alpha 0 and alpha 1 do the same job, okay, are identical. So that's the very rough idea. Now, you say, well, where was this minimal condition on stabilizers? Well, the point is the following. Popa proved such a thing for actions that are mixing. Now, what does it mean in our setting? This action here is mixing if and only if the stabilizer of any point I is finite. And then everything goes fine very well. Now, of course, if the stabilizer of a single point is finite, then you have this minimal condition on stabilizers. Here you already are at a finite group, and then at a certain point it stops. Now, if you don't have any more this mixing property, you need something to get control over many, many technical details. And the something you can use is the minimal condition on stabilizers. Now, namely that the stabilizers at a certain point arrive at the trivial subgroup. So that's step one. Now step two. So I'm still oversimplifying. Yeah, I'm still with the same kind of 2-1 factor, and I'm still with an automorphism. But now because of step one, I know that L of gamma is preserved globally. So that was my first step. And now I want to show that in fact also the Cartan subalgebras are preserved after a unitary conjugacy. Where does this come from? Well, a first step is the following. I claim that if I fix some point in I, it doesn't matter which, and take gamma zero, it's stabilized. And recall that it was crucial that this stabilizer acts with infinite orbits anywhere else than in the point I0. And I claim that psi of L of gamma 0 and L of gamma 0 are again unitarily conjugate. So why? This is very strange. Well, if not, and here I make a strange claim, well, if not, there is this technique that Popa calls intertwining by bimodules that gives some strong dichotomy. If psi of L of gamma 0 is not unitarily conjugate to L of gamma 0, in some very precise sense, it goes very far away from L of gamma 0. Now, look very well. If you go very far away from gamma 0, this means that you go very far away from this stabilizer of one point, and it will mean, it will imply you that you have no more invariant elements on the space level. It will imply you that relative commutant of psi of L of gamma 0 must sit entirely in L of gamma. And this is a contradiction because this psi of L of gamma 0 has some relative commutant that comes from your L infinity of x, yeah, from your point I0. So that's the first point. And once you're there, if you accept this, you can take relative commutants and you already preserve something automatically. Namely, functions only depending on the variable I0 are already somehow preserved for free. And then you have to play a game, and I don't explain it, but you can somehow imagine that once you have one little bit that's preserved, then you have to play some algebraic game, and you really arrive at conjugacy of these two algebras. Anyway, now it's time to wake up again and to do something conceptual. So we are now at a good point. So we took our bimodule, we simplified and assumed that it's an automorphism, and now we know that it's preserving Cartan subalgebra. Now something conceptual comes in again. Namely, there is a very strong relation between such bimodules or automorphisms and cocycles. So let me show you this. Because in fact, as was already explained, once your automorphism preserves Cartan subalgebra, its restriction to L infinity of X is in fact an orbit equivalence. So it means that if I write, and I should say this here, psi restricted to L infinity of X is nothing else than, say, given by a map from X to X, of course, probability measure preserving, and then this map that preserves the probability measure, in fact, sends orbits to orbits almost everywhere. But then I have an associated Zimmer 1 cocycle, yeah? Because the delta of gx must be in the same orbit as delta x, I take the unique element in gamma that indeed relates it to delta of x. And that's a one cocycle. But now there is, as Sorin showed us, his cocycle superrigidity theorem from 2005. And it says the following. For instance, if you take this kind of Bernoulli action, but you might take some more general actions as well, and if you have an almost normal subgroup with relative t acting with infinite orbits, and if G is, well, there is a larger class of groups, but it includes all countable groups and all compact groups, then any one cocycle with values in G must be cohomologous to a one cocycle that's independent of the space variable, namely a homomorphism from gamma to G. And it's crucial to remember towards the next slide that we will need this theorem both for countable target groups and for compact target groups. Both will be needed in the next slide. And one I can explain you already. So we were at this point where our automorphism preserves Cartan subalgebra. So we have this Zimmer 1 cocycle. It's a one cocycle with values in gamma. And I apply to it Popper's theorem. Okay? But what comes out? Well, what comes out is that, in fact, this psi restricted to L infinity of X is, in fact, a conjugacy of the actions. So a conjugacy of the actions, meaning that there comes out an automorphism of your group. In fact, delta of GX is nothing else than delta G delta X. But does this entirely describe my automorphism? Well, not yet. It says what the automorphism does on L infinity of X. On L infinity of X, it's a nice conjugacy of the action with itself. A conjugacy of the action with itself is nothing else than an element of the normalizer of gamma in the group of automorphisms of X, of course. But what does it do on this L of gamma? Well, on this L of gamma, it still has some mystery part. You write psi of u g as u delta g times some element in L infinity of X, which will define you a one cocycle with values in S1, the circle group. But this again, now you can apply cocycle superrigidity with this target group being S1. So you also kill this one cocycle, and it becomes a character. Now, I said that I made this oversimplification, that namely looking only at automorphisms rather than bimodules. So what is the real change? There are, of course, many technical changes, but here there is an important change, namely I won't find some conjugacy of the action with itself, but only a conjugacy up to finite index. So this normalizer is replaced by a commensurator. And then, of course, here this S1 will be replaced by any unitary group of n by n matrices, yeah? So, and you will really need the cocycle superrigidity theorem with as a target group n by n unitary matrices, not only as one. And instead of a character, you find a finite dimensional representation. So here we are really at the point where your bimodule is entirely described by a finite dimensional representation of gamma and some thing we still don't master, namely the commensurator of gamma in this group of automorphisms. So those who are lost, I think here is a point you can again start to follow, because now we will do something very concrete, namely take Bernoulli action. And first of all, take the plane Bernoulli action. Well, this means that gamma acts on gamma itself, and you look at this action. As one of the open problems in Sorin's list explained, it's an open problem to determine even the centralizer of gamma inside the automorphisms of X nu. So all automorphisms commuting with these actions, we cannot describe them. So certainly not this commensurator, yeah? This is, well, if you solve the problem on the centralizer, you probably solve the problem on the commensurator. Anyway. On the other hand, if you consider such a generalized Bernoulli action, it's quite an easy observation to describe the whole commensurator under two conditions, namely take a transitive action and suppose that such a stabilizer of one point acts with infinite orbits anywhere else. Then it's quite easy to tell you what are exactly the automorphisms of X that commensurate gamma. Namely, you have two obvious ones. Of course, you can take an automorphism of your base space X0 and then take it diagonally to produce some automorphism of X that commutes with the hull of gamma. So this is the stupid part, say. But then there is another part, namely, you can shift the indices. So you can take a permutation of I, you shift the indices in your infinite product, and you shift the indices with an element that commensurates gamma. And of course, in general, you always have the right-hand side inside the left-hand side. But why should it be everything? Now, it is everything in this case where the stabilizer acts with infinite orbits because of the very simple observation that under such condition, if I take all functions on X that are invariant under this stabilizer, that's the same as looking at functions that only depend on the I0th variable. So that's a little argument. And once you are there, you somehow can recognize your base space in an abstract way, and this will give you this automorphism, and you can start to play a game. It's really an easy thing to do. So that's where this condition crucially comes from. Now, let me specialize to the automorphism group, yeah? So, of course, the result you get, once you have the fusion algebra, you have the automorphism group, and here is the precise statement reinterpreting the previous one. Namely, you have these trivial automorphisms, you have the characters of gamma, and then you had this, I had this commensurator. Of gamma in this permutation group. Now, if you restrict to automorphisms, it will be the normalizer. And this normalizer will be nothing else than basically automorphisms of gamma globally preserving the subgroup gamma zero. This is, again, a very little computation, yeah? So here is a very explicit group-like description of the outer automorphism group of your to one factor. If you want, this gives you also the simplest possible example, I think, of a to one factor where you have no outer automorphisms. So you take an atomic base space with distinct weights, and you take this gamma acting on I for n odd and at least 3. This gives you a continuous family of to one factors without outer automorphisms. There, every term is killed. Yeah. Now, let me finally explain why it also gives you any countable group as an outer automorphism group. Well, here is the very easy action of some gamma on some set I. Well, lambda is an arbitrary ICC group satisfying this minimal condition on centralizers, and just a trivial condition, lambda is not a direct product. So of course, most groups are not a direct product. And then I take this gamma acting on I, and which is the outer automorphism group that comes out? It's a completely group-like thing. is the outer automorphism group of your group lambda, and then some annoying terms, characters of lambda, and one copy of the group with two elements. The group with two elements, by the way, appearing because I can flip these two. Anyway, some group theory people showed that any countable group can in fact arise as the outer automorphism group of this group lambda. And it's not just an existence statement, because what Boumagin and Weiss did is, given your lambda, they have some algorithm, some concrete way of writing a presentation of a group. Now, given a group G, they have an algorithm that writes a presentation for lambda with outer automorphisms of lambda given by G. And how do they do this? This is with some classical group theory type construction. It's called Ripps construction, and it's a small cancellation group. Now, it's not too hard to be a little smarter and to have a construction where you don't have this group of two elements. And of course, you in this Boumagin-Weiss result, you can immediately read that you take groups which have no character share, which are equal to their first derived subgroup. That's quite obvious. So once you have killed these things here, you really then have a 2-1 factor with this arbitrary countable group as an outer automorphism group. So before I stop, let me show one last slide about some existence theorems, because I just explained you that the outer automorphism group can be any countable group. And since this Boumagin-Weiss thing is extremely concrete, it gives you a presentation of your group lambda in terms of the desired outer automorphism group, that's a completely constructive way of obtaining M. But before, there were some existence theorems in this direction, namely Joanna, Peterson, and Popa showed that this outer automorphism group can be any compact abelian group. But it was an existence theorem. I won't go into the reason why it is, but it involves basically bare category theorem to find somewhere a non-trivial element. Yeah, and you can, by the way, adapt, that's rather straightforward, you can adapt this argument to in fact get any compact group as the outer automorphism group of a 2-1 factor, but still an existence theorem. So that's now somehow the status of what this outer automorphism group can be. There is no construction, but it can be any compact group. It can be any countable group. What else can it be? I have, of course, no idea. I don't think I will think more about that, but it might be an interesting question. Thank you very much.